Welcome to Navigating Life with Neurodiversity, a podcast about identity, healing, and honest conversations for those who feel deeply, think differently, and live uniquely. My name is Matt, and I'm glad you're here. In today's episode, we're diving into a fascinating and important topic, attachment theory and neurodiversity. We'll talk about how the way we bond with others, our attachment style, plays out in neurodiverse relationships. And this matters for everyone, because whether it's a romantic partnership, a parent-child relationship, or a friendship, understanding attachment can help us love and support each other better. Why focus on neurodiversity and attachment? Well, neurodiversity means recognizing that the brains work differently, and many people are neurodivergent. For example, on the autism spectrum, living with ADHD, these things can affect how we connect and communicate. Maybe you're neurodivergent, or you might love someone who is. You might have noticed moments of misunderstanding or extra challenges in your relationship. Attachment theory gives us a lens to understand these moments. It is a framework from within psychology that explains how we form emotional bonds and why we might feel secure or anxious in our relationships. By combining attachment theory with insights about neurodiversity, we can find better ways to support each other, creating stronger, more understanding relationships. Because the grass isn't necessarily greener on the other side of the fence, it's greenest where you water it. In this episode, we're going to cover a lot of ground. First, I'm going to give a quick overview of attachment theory, including the four attachment styles and how they show up in adult life. And then we'll look at what attachment means for neurodivergent folks, especially those with autism spectrum disorders or ADHD. And we're going to bust some myths like that old wrong idea that autistic people can't form attachments. We'll discuss the unique challenges and the amazing strengths in neurodiverse couples. We've also got insights from therapy, what approaches like EFT, emotionally focused therapy, CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, and DBT, delectable behavioral therapy, can offer neurodiverse partners. We'll even highlight some recent research, like how difficulties with understanding others' thoughts, mentalization, can affect attachment security, or how ADHD-related impulsivity and emotional swings impact relationship stability. And stick around to the end, because we'll sum up some key takeaways, share some resources, and even answer a couple of questions that have been sent in via personal message on this topic. So whether you're neurotypical, neurodivergent, or just curious about how people connect, I think you can find something useful in today's episode. Attachment styles and neurodiversity are both big parts of what makes each relationship unique. So let's get started on understanding them. Let's begin with a quick attachment theory 101. Attachment theory was first developed by psychologist John Bowlby and later expanded on by Mary Ainsworth in the mid-20th century. In simple terms, attachment refers to the deep emotional bond that forms between a child and their caregiver. Think of it this way. As infants, we're helpless, so we're wired to latch on to caregivers for safety. If things go well, that caregiver becomes a secure base, someone the child trusts to be there when needed. You might see a baby crawl away to explore, but keep looking back to make sure that mum or dad is still there. That's attachment in action. When the caregiver leaves and comes back, the child's reaction tells us a lot about that bond. These early patterns create an attachment style, basically our default setting for how we emotionally connect, which can carry over into adulthood. Psychologists generally talk about four main attachment styles: secure, anxious, avoidant, and disorganized, also called fearful avoidant. Let's break those down with some relatable adult examples. So first off is secure attachment. About half of people in an ideal world have this style. If you're secure, you're comfortable with intimacy and being independent. You trust others will be there for you and you're there for them. For example, a securely attached adult can communicate their needs openly and handle it when their partner needs space. This style usually comes from having consistent, responsive care in childhood. your caregivers made you feel safe, so you grew up believing that you could rely on loved ones. Anxious attachment, sometimes called anxious preoccupied, these people crave closeness, and they're often worried about rejection or abandonment. If you have an anxious style, you might feel needy or insecure in relationships, like constantly texting your partner to make sure that they still love you, or feeling panicky if they don't reply quickly. An anxiously attached adult can become consumed with concern that loved ones will abandon them, seeking constant reassurance that the relationship is okay. Now, this often traces back to inconsistent caregiving. Sometimes your needs were met, sometimes not. So as a child, you were never sure, and you grew up hypervigilant about love not disappearing. This attachment style can also be learned in adulthood from inconsistent relationships, abusive relationships, or backgrounds with toxic partners. Thirdly, we have an avoidant attachment, also called dismissive. And this is kind of the flip side. An avoidantly attached person values their independence so much that they are uncomfortable with too much closeness or emotional disclosure. They might come off as emotionally distant, preferring to solve problems solo and not talk about their feelings. In a relationship, an avoidant person might say, "I need a lot of space," or get overwhelmed when a partner seeks support. This style can develop if a child's early caregivers were emotionally unavailable or not responsive. The child learns to self-soothe instead of relying on others. As an adult, someone with an avoidant style might avoid deep emotional conversations and intimacy because they've learned not to trust that others will meet their emotional needs. Finally, we have disorganized attachment, or fearful avoidance. This one is more complex and significantly rarer. It often stems from trauma or very inconsistent caregiving. It's called disorganized because it's a mix of behaviors. The person desperately wants connection, like someone anxious, but is also terrified of it, like someone avoidant. In adult relationships, a disorganized attachment might look like, "Come here, no, go away, I'm scared you'll hurt me, but I need you," cycles. There's a lot of fear involved. For example, a person might intensely seek closeness, then suddenly push their partner away or sabotage the relationship when it gets too intimate, because closeness itself feels unsafe. This can happen if a child's caregiver was a source of fear or harm. Imagine a child who wants comfort, but with a parent who is frightening and abusive. This result is an approach avoidance conflict that continues into later relationships. Disorganized individuals often struggle with self-regulation and trust, given their early experiences were so chaotic. This attachment style is often seen in people with bipolar disorder, borderline personality disorder, or similar conditions, and it stems from trauma in childhood. Now, an important point, attachment styles aren't set in stone. They can change with new experiences. You might be anxious with one partner, but find security with another who's very reassuring, for instance. Or a secure person under extreme stress might start behaving more anxiously or avoidantly. Think of attachment style as a tendency or default setting. Useful to understand, but each individual and relationship is unique. Also, we all have some mix of these styles. It's often a spectrum, but having the language for these patterns is really helpful. People often talk about hearing about attachment styles and not realizing they've been doing the pursue-withdraw dance in their relationship for years. And when learning about attachment styles, they name it as the first step to change. One common dynamic we see is the pursuer-distancer cycle. Typically an anxious person pursuing a response and an avoidant person withdrawing. Each person's coping strategy triggers the other. The more one chases, i.e. talk to me, I need to know that you're here for me, the more the other runs, quotes like, "I can't handle this right now," and then it spirals. Understanding that these reactions come from attachment fears, fear of abandonment on one side and fear of being overwhelmed or rejected on the other, can help couples to break this cycle. The pursuer can learn to give a bit of space, and the withdrawer can learn to give reassurance before taking space. We'll talk later about how therapies like EFT help with exactly this, turning that cycle of protest poker into a secure connection. So that's attachment theory in a nutshell. Now, keep these stars in mind as we shift on to our main focus, which is how attachment plays out for neurodivergent individuals. Start by defining neurodiversity, in case some listeners are new to the term. Neurodiversity simply means there's a natural variation in how our brains work. Conditions like autism and ADHD are examples of neurodivergence. Different neurological profiles that are part of humans' natural diversity. Being neurodivergent often comes with differences in social communication, sensory experience, attention, and emotional regulation. So you might wonder, do those differences affect how someone forms attachments or what their attachment styles look like? The short answer is yes, they can, but perhaps not in the simplistic ways that people used to think. There is a harmful myth out there that autistic people lack attachment or don't love others. To dispel that right now, autistic individuals do form deep attachments and love their family, partners, and friends. They just might express it differently. In fact, studies have shown that many children with autism form secure attachments to caregivers, using them as a safe space, similar to neurotypical children. One early study described how infants with autism still showed attachment behaviours like making eye contact, touching, vocalising, and showing distress when a caregiver leaves. So the capacity to attach is absolutely there. The difference is that some traits of autism, like difficulty with social cues or sensory sensitivities, can make those attachments appear unusual to outsiders or can sometimes strain the typical back and forth of bonding. As an autistic adult, I want people to know that I do feel love and empathy, even if I don't always show it in a standard way. For example, I might not say I love you all the time or enjoy big hugs, but I might show love by spending time in your interests or doing practical things for you. For example, I'll fix your computer or remember to do a chore that helps you out, and that is me saying I care. Research backs this up. Autistic individuals often feel affection and empathy, but may struggle to express it in conventional ways. Our brain's empathy circuits work differently, but different doesn't mean lacking. So if an autistic person isn't giving you the Hallmark movie kind of romance, it doesn't mean that they don't love you. They might just be speaking love in a different language. And that's important, because in attachment terms, an autistic partner might securely feel attached, but show it differently. For instance, an autistic person might not like hugging or might need more personal space, not because they don't trust or love you, but perhaps due to sensory sensitivities. One analysis noted that avoiding physical affection, like hugging or kissing, in an autistic individual could be due to sensory overwhelm rather than an attachment problem. In other words, the reason for a similar behaviour can differ. A neurotypical person with an avoidant attachment might pull back from hugs due to a fear of closeness, whereas an autistic person might pull back because the hug feels physically overwhelming. Their need for love is still there, it's just the expression that differs. How about ADHD, for example, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder? This can also influence attachment. People with ADHD often struggle with impulsivity, focus, and emotional regulation. If you think about it, those challenges can impact relationships a lot. For example, someone with ADHD might forget to text back, not because they don't care, but because their attention wandered. Or they might blurt out something hurtful in a heated moment due to impulsivity, even though they deeply love their partner. Over time, these patterns can create insecurity on both sides. In fact, research shows adults with ADHD have a much higher incidence of insecure attachment styles than the general population. And that means that they are more likely to report anxious or avoidant patterns, possibly because of the way ADHD symptoms and life experiences intertwine with relationships. If you grew up with undiagnosed ADHD, for instance, you might have frequently been scolded or felt hard to handle, which could contribute to feeling insecure in relationships later. We often see ADHD and attachment issues feeding each other. ADHD can make consistency hard. You might be super affectionate one day and then distracted and distant the next without meaning to. The partner might get anxious, thinking, did I do something wrong? Meanwhile, the ADHD partner might feel emotions intensely, but have trouble self-soothing. One concept relevant here is rejection sensitive dysphoria, which many people with ADHD experience. It's basically an extreme sensitivity to real or perceived rejection. So an ADHD partner might quickly feel unloved or rejected by small things, mildly critical comment, or the partner choosing to spend an evening alone. And that pain can trigger either anxious clinging or avoidant pushing away to protect themselves. It can look like an attachment roller coaster, which it is. We're dealing with both the attachment system and the neurodivergent nervous systems in overdrive. So in an ADHD neurotypical pairing, you might have one partner who misreads neutral events as rejection and then reacts strongly. Meanwhile, the other partner is left baffled, thinking, where did that outburst come from? Or they might feel that they have to walk on eggshells. Without understanding these dynamics, it can really strain the bond. Another factor is mentalization, basically the ability to understand what's going on in someone else's mind and your own. This is also called theory of the mind. Some neurodivergent people, especially autistic individuals, can have difficulty with mentalizing others' emotions. If you struggle to read social cues or interpret facial expression, you might not realize your friend is upset with you, or that your spouse needs a hug after a bad day, unless they say it plainly. And this isn't because you don't care, it's a neurological blind spot in picking up unspoken signals. Research has noted that people on the autism spectrum often have trouble recognizing and responding to others' mental states or emotions, due to these mentalizing difficulties. Now imagine how that affects attachment. If you miss cues, you might inadvertently not respond when your partner reaches out for comfort, causing them to feel insecure. Or the neurotypical partner might misinterpret the autistic partner's blank expression as a they don't care, when in reality, the autistic partner simply isn't reflecting emotion on their face or didn't catch the hint. And these crossed wires can lead to a lot of pain if not understood. To illustrate this with a story, meet the fictional couple Alex and Sam. Alex is neurotypical with an anxious attachment style, and Sam is autistic with what looks like an avoidant attachment style. In the early days of their relationship, Alex would often say things like, I feel like you don't care about me, because Sam didn't initiate cuddling, or often said they needed time alone in the evening. Alex, who fears rejection, would interpret Sam's need for alone time as a bad sign. Are they mad at me? Do they secretly not love me? So Alex would pursue Sam more, texting frequently, asking, are you okay? Is everything all right with us? Seeking reassurance. Sam, on the other hand, would feel overwhelmed by these texts and questions. After a long day of navigating social interactions at work, Sam's autistic brain was exhausted and just needed some quiet downtime. This is sometimes called autistic burnout, or simply recharging. Sam's withdrawal wasn't about Alex at all, it was about recovering their own energy. Alex didn't know that, and Sam didn't know how to explain it in a way that Alex would understand. The result? Miscommunication. Alex's anxious attachment system was triggered by Sam's behaviour, and Sam's stress was amplified by Alex's intense emotional demands at the wrong time. They hit a lot of ruptures, moment of disconnection and hurt. And as one resource points out, neurodivergence can increase the risk of ruptures in relationships and make it harder to repair trust afterwards if you don't address what's happening. Alex might start believing, maybe I'm just too much for Sam, and Sam might think Alex will never understand my needs. These beliefs can harden into an insecure attachment loop between them. The good news is that once Alex and Sam learned about their neurodiverse differences and their attachment triggers, they could start to turn things around. Alex learned that Sam withdrawing each evening wasn't a silent treatment or a sign of lack of love. It was Sam's way to self-regulate, And Sam learned that a small gesture could reassure Alex, even if it was something as simple as saying, "I love you, I just need some quiet time to recharge, I'll be back." Or sending a text later at night to connect. This is actually a strategy we call a ritual of connection or ritual of separation. For example, one psychologist suggests that anxiously attached individuals feel safer if a partner creates consistent little routines, like always saying goodbye with a hug and "I'll see you tonight," maybe a check-in text during the day. Those predictable gestures can greatly soothe an anxious attachment. Alex and Sam started doing that. A goodnight message every night, even if apart. A hug before Sam went into alone time mode. Over time, Alex became less anxious and gave Sam more space. And Sam felt safer to show affection when rested. They essentially taught each other how to meet their attachment needs in a neurodiversity-friendly way. It highlights something crucial. Communication and understanding are key. Neurodivergent people often express attachment and love differently from neurotypical partners, as this story illustrates. But different doesn't mean deficient. An autistic partner might be incredibly loyal and show love through actions rather than words. An ADHD partner might bring fun, passionate energy to the relationship, even if they forget the occasional appointment. In the next section, I'm going to delve deeper into relationship challenges and strengths common in neurodiverse couples. But before I move on to tackle one more misconception explicitly, the idea that neurodivergent individuals don't form secure attachments. In reality, they absolutely can and do. Studies, while mixed, have found a sizable proportion of autistic children, around 47 to 53%, have secure attachments to caregivers, only somewhat lower than in neurotypical populations. And many autistic and ADHD adults have loving, long-term relationships. It's just that neurodiversity can sometimes make insecure attachment more likely if the person's needs aren't understood or met growing up. One article noted that neurodivergence alone doesn't doom anyone to insecurity. It's often one piece of a complex puzzle. Plenty of neurodiverse kids and adults are secure, especially when their caregivers or partners respond to their unique communication and sensory needs. So the takeaway, neurodivergence doesn't equal insecure attachment, but it can influence how attachment behaviours manifest. At this midpoint, I hope it's become very clear that I put an awful lot of time and research into some of these posts. If you or someone you may know may benefit from the insights shared within this episode, please like, subscribe, share it around. Let's paint a picture of what neurodiverse couples might experience in their day-to-day relationship. By neurodiverse couples, we mean a couple where one or both partners are neurodivergent. For example, one partner is autistic and the other is not, or one has ADHD, or both partners are neurodivergent in possibly different ways. These relationships can be incredibly rich and fulfilling, but they may also face some unique challenges. And we'll talk about the tough stuff, the miscommunication, emotional regulation issues, differing needs, and the wonderful strengths like the fierce loyalty, honesty, a deep connection over shared interests, and a creative problem solving. First, the challenges. One big one is miscommunication. Neurodivergent and neurotypical brains can be like speaking slightly different dialects of the same language. For example, neurotypical people often rely on subtle nonverbal cues, a sigh, a tone of voice, a look, to convey or interpret meaning. As an autistic partner, we might not pick up on those cues or might interpret them very differently. As we've mentioned, they might miss that you're upset, or conversely, they might seem brusque or unemotional because their facial expression and tone don't match what a neurotypical expects. It's not surprising that misunderstandings happen. One partner says, "Leave me alone," during a meltdown, meaning "I'm overwhelmed right now," and the other partner thinks that means "I don't love you anymore." Later, hurt feelings abound on both sides. Emotional regulation is another sticking point. Both autism and ADHD can come with intense emotional experiences or difficulty managing emotions. An autistic person might experience sensory or emotional overload that leads to a shutdown or a meltdown, a burst of anger or tears not necessarily directed at anyone, but simply due to being overwhelmed. An ADHD partner might have quick shifts in mood or a hot temper in the moment, even if they regret it later. They might also experience something called rejection sensitivity, as previously mentioned, where even mild criticism feels devastating. This means a small argument can escalate fast. The neurodivergent partner might react in an extreme way, which then scares or confuses the other partner, triggering their attachment insecurities. One unexpected but fun aspect of me starting this podcast is people have interacted with me in ways that perhaps I didn't think they would, sending me questions, discussing their own experiences, and it's been nice to hear that I'm sometimes not alone in feeling the way that I feel. One such question I got was from Chris. Chris has got ADHD, and his partner says that he goes from 0 to 100 in arguments, like he gets too upset over little things, and then later on feels ashamed. He also gets super anxious if she leaves after they fight. He wants to know if that's either his ADHD or his attachment style or what, and how can he handle it better? It's a good question, and it is important to note that I am not an expert. I've done a fair amount of reading and research into this topic before putting this video together. So I suggest it could be a combination of both the ADHD and an attachment style. Many people with ADHD have an anxious attachment style, although not all. It is possibly because of past experiences of being misunderstood. That 0 to 100 feeling sounds like what I experience in rejection sensitivity, where a perceived slight trigger intensifies a fear of losing the relationship. So maybe you're lashing out in a panic as a way to cope. First step is to recognize it for what it is. It's your brain sounding a false alarm that a small conflict equals abandonment. One strategy is to practice a pause. When you feel that surge, take a break. It might even help for you to name what's happening to your partner. You could tell them that you're feeling triggered and you need a few minutes to calm down so you don't say something that you might later regret. During that pause, you can use coping skills like splashing water on your face, doing some deep breathing, which is a classic DBT skill, or even write down what you're feeling before saying it. Over time, these habits retrain your response. Also, talk with your partner, when you're calm, about this pattern. Come up with a signal or a plan. For instance, you could agree that if you start raising your voice, your partner gently points out, or you use a code word to take a break. The key is reassuring your attachment system that conflict does not mean disaster. Therapy can help a lot here too, and we'll talk more about that later. But you're not alone, and many with ADHD report exactly what you've described, and it can get better with understanding and practice. Another common challenge is that different needs for space and closeness. And this often plays out as one partner feeling the other is too distant or too clingy, depending on their styles. We see it in the Alex and Sam example. One needed more autonomy and downtime, partly due to neurodivergent needs, and the other needed more frequent connection. Neither of them is wrong, but it does cause conflict. An autistic individual may genuinely need regular solitude or a predictable routine to function well. For example, they might have a nightly routine of winding down alone to lower their anxiety. A neurotypical partner might interpret that as avoidance or lack of interest, if they don't necessarily understand the reasons. On the flip side, an ADHD individual might crave stimulation and connection, possibly overwhelming a partner who needs quiet. Or if the ADHD partner is the one needing space at times, since ADHD can also sometimes lead to burnout from social overstimulation, the other partner might wonder why they can be so outgoing one day and so withdrawn the next. These ebbs and flows can mirror anxious avoidant dynamics, and that they can cause confusion for both people if they don't connect it to its neurodivergent traits. One thing to emphasise for neurodiverse couples is the concept of double empathy problem. And this is a theory by autism researcher Damian Milton that basically says communication difficulties in autism are a two-way street. It's not just the autistic person failing to empathise or communicate in a neurotypical way. It is also the neurotypical person failing to understand the autistic way. Both sides experience a gap, realising this helps couples frame conflicts, not as one person's fault, but as a mutual difference to work through. For instance, a neurotypical might need to explicitly ask, "How are you feeling?" rather than relying on reading the mood. And an autistic might need to learn that when their partner is silent with their arms crossed, it usually means that something is bothering them, and that maybe a hug or an apology might be in order. It goes both ways. Now, it's not all challenges. Far from it. Neurodiverse couples have some incredible strengths that often don't get talked about enough. So let's shine a light on those. Loyalty and commitment. Many partners of neurodivergent individuals say that their loved one is fiercely loyal. If an autistic person commits to a relationship, they may very well be in it for the long haul. And approach it with a strong sense of duty and sincerity. They're less likely to play mind games or be fickle. One source even noted that honesty and loyalty are two remarkable qualities autistic individuals often bring to relationships. They aren't usually interested in cheating or deception. In fact, lying doesn't come easily to many autistic folks. Similarly, ADHD partners, despite the stereotype of distraction, can be deeply loyal and protective of those they love. They might even hyper-focus on their partner in positive moments, showering them with attention and affection. A piece in Attitude magazine, spelled A-D-D-itude, mentioned that partners with ADHD are often among the most generous, engaged, fun, and loyal people, bringing a spark to the relationship that is truly special. Authenticity and honesty. As mentioned, neurodivergent folks tend to be authentic. Autistic partners in particular tell it like it is. They're not typically manipulative or playing social games. What you see is what you get. This can be refreshing in a relationship. You don't have to second guess if their "I love you" is genuine or if their silence is hiding something. Usually they mean exactly what they say or don't say. This straightforwardness can build a lot of trust. In attachment terms, consistency and transparency help to foster security. The NT, neurotypical partner, might come to highly value that their ND partner won't pretend or put on an act. You know where you stand. As one resource puts it, the autistic partner's allegiance to the truth can sometimes override social niceties, but it engenders trust in the relationship because you know they're not trying to deceive you. Unique ways of connecting. Neurodiverse couples often bond over shared interests or intellectual connection on a deep level. If one partner has a special interest, say astronomy or coding or an obscure book series, that passion can be infectious and become a source of mutual enjoyment. Engaging in these interests together can create a very strong emotional connection that's different from typical lovey-dovey romance, but just as meaningful. It's like creating your own world together. Also, neurodivergent individuals might show love in creative ways. We heard an example, an autistic spouse ironing shirts or fixing things as a love language. An ADHD partner might write a spontaneous love note or plan a surprise outing full of excitement. When both partners recognize these as expressions of love, it's very bonding. Problem solving and resilience. Many neurodiverse couples get very good at problem solving because, frankly, they have to navigate atypical challenges. If you've ever seen two people, say one autistic and one neurotypical, negotiating a social event, it's like watching expert diplomats. Okay, you handle the small talk, I take breaks every 20 minutes, and we'll have a signal if we need to leave early.
these types of things are quite common. They often come up with innovative solutions and routines that work for them, even if they might be unorthodox. This ability to adapt can be a huge strength, especially once they get past blaming each other and start treating it as a teamwork exercise. One article noted that neurodivergent individuals can have a unique problem-solving approach, viewing other situations from a different angle that leads to creative solutions that aren't obvious to others. In relationships, this can mean finding novel ways to compromise and meet each other's needs. Overcoming challenges together can make the relationship stronger. You've been through the wars and come out united. Deep intimacy. This might not be true for every neurodiverse couple, but many report that once the understanding is built, their intimacy is incredibly deep. It's as if truly seeing and accepting each other's differences creates a profound bond. The partner feels like, you understand me like no one else does, even the messy, quirky parts of me. For a neurodivergent person who maybe felt misunderstood by others their whole life, having a partner who gets it is huge for trust and attachment security. And for the partner, being let into the inner world of the ND person, which they might not show to anyone else, is a special kind of emotional intimacy. They often have their own love language and routines that make sense just to them. It might not look like a standard romance, but from the outside, but it is theirs and it works. To share a quick story from a listener and friend highlighting some of the strengths in their relationship, this is about a female friend who is neurotypical and her autistic husband. So she says in her point of view, in the beginning, she struggled with the fact that her partner never said the flowery stuff like "you're beautiful" or "I missed you," and that often led to her doubting if he loved her. But gradually she realized that he showed love in other ways. He remembers every important detail about her. He noticed when I was running low on her favorite snacks or more. He learned how to make her grandmother's soup when he was sick, even though he hates cooking. He's incredibly loyal and honest. She knows she never has to worry about him lying or betraying her. After 5 years, she appreciates that he's not a smooth talker. If he says something, she knows he means it. She's described him as her rock. And when she's upset, he might not fully know what to do, but he will sit with her and listen or just quietly be there. Their communication has improved a lot. They even have some quirky routines that help them. Every Friday, they have a pizza and movie night. No surprise, which he likes. And when she wants a hug, she just opens her arms and he knows that's his cue. He's more comfortable responding to that direct cue, and it works for them, and she feels very loved. And I love that story, because it shows that with understanding and a bit of adaptation, neurodiverse relationships can flourish, with both partners feeling secure. In their case, they found a system, explicit communication and routine, pizza night, clear cues for affection, created a safe, predictable pattern that suits them both. In fact, experts often suggest establishing routines, clear communication, and explicit signals in neurodiverse relationships for exactly this reason. It reduces ambiguity and anxiety for both sides. So to sum up this section, challenges in neurodiverse couples might include miscommunications, heightened conflict from emotional dysregulation, sensory and social differences that cause misunderstandings, and differing intimacy needs. But the strengths include honesty, loyalty, unique bonds over shared interests, creative problem solving, and often a very authentic, profound connection. Recognizing the difference between an attachment issue and a neurodivergent trait is key. Is your partner avoiding eye contact because they're lying, attachment issue, or because the eye contact is physically uncomfortable, autism trait? Is your partner glued to you because they fear abandoned, attachment issue, or because ADHD hyperfocus has them intensely fixated on you in that moment? Neurodivergence. Often it's a mix, but teasing it apart together can be a game-changing. And remember, any attachment style combination can show in ND couples. You might have an autistic person who is anxiously attached and a neurotypical who is avoidant, or vice versa. It's complex. But communication and empathy on both sides go a long way to leveraging strengths and navigating the rough spots.
Just another quick interval to remind you that if you or anyone around you might benefit from hearing this discussion, please feel free to share it, tag them in it, have them reach out. The engagement always helps. Thanks very much for listening. So if you've been listening to any of this and thinking, this is me or this is us, what can we do to make things better? This section is for you. The great news is that there are therapeutic approaches and practical strategies specifically geared towards helping neurodiverse couples and individuals foster more secure attachments and better communication. I'm going to talk about a few big ones, like emotionally focused therapy, or EFT, cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT, and dialectical behavior therapy, DBT. Also, some everyday tools that you can start using right away at home. Plus, we'll highlight how building attachment security is a learnable skill, not something you either have or don't. So let's start with emotionally focused therapy, or EFT for couples. EFT is a well-researched, short-term couples therapy approach delivered by Dr. Sue Johnson. Based directly on attachment theory, the goal of EFT is to help partners create a secure bond by identifying the emotional needs under their conflicts and fostering empathy and connection. It's all about changing those negative cycles, like the pursue-withdraw cycle we've discussed, into positive ones. How does it work? In EFT, the therapist guides the couple through recognizing the deeper feelings they might not be expressing. For example, instead of the surface anger, like you've never done the dishes, the therapist helps one partner say maybe, I feel lonely and worried, you don't care when we don't spend time together, revealing the vulnerable feeling. The other partner is helped to really hear that and perhaps respond with reassurance instead of defensiveness. Over multiple sessions, couples practice this safer, emotionally honest communication. Why EFT is so great for neurodiverse couples? Because it doesn't assume the couples communicate in a neurotypical way. It actually creates a structured space for communication. The therapist often acts as a translator or mediator, which can be very useful if one partner struggles with emotional expression, like alexithymia in autism, difficulty identifying and naming emotions, or if one tends to withdraw. EFT slows things down and focuses on the feelings and the needs underneath the behaviours. For example, an autistic partner who goes quiet might, with the therapist's help, learn to say, "It's not that I don't care, it's that I'm overwhelmed right now." The neurotypical partner might learn to hear that as, "I need comfort too. I'm just showing it differently," instead of as rejection. Importantly, EFT frames negative behaviours as protests of disconnection, basically attachment distress signals. So an angry outburst or a shutdown is seen not simply as bad behaviour, but as a sign of unmet attachment needs, like I'm scared you'll leave or I feel not accepted as I am. This perspective can build empathy. Partners begin to see each other's inner child, so to speak, rather than villainising each other. Over time, EFT helps couples become more emotionally available and responsive to each other, creating a safe haven in the relationship. For neurodiverse couples, that safe haven might include very personalized rituals or accommodations, but the emotional security is the core outcome. There have been cases of EFT used specifically with neurodiverse couples with great success. One study isn't specifically EFT, but a solution-focused couples therapy where a couple with an autistic partner showed improvement communication and emotional awareness after just 12 sessions. EFT being emotion focused likely facilitates that kind of improvement by design. The therapist may adapt it, like giving it more time for an autistic person to process a question or using visual aids if needed. If you and your partner struggle with those pursue withdraw cycles or misunderstand each other's emotional cues, seeking out an EFT trained couples therapist, ideally one familiar with neurodiversity, could be immensely helpful. Many couples that report going from feeling like adversaries back to feeling like a team once they rebuild that secure emotional bond. Next, let's talk about CBT, which is cognitive behavioral therapy, and DBT, dialectical behavioral therapy, as well as a few other skills training approaches. These are more individual-focused therapies, but can greatly benefit relationships by helping each person to work on themselves. CBT is about identifying and changing unhelpful thought patterns and behaviours. And how does that relate to attachment and neurodiversity? Well, say you have an anxious attachment. You might have thoughts like, I know they're going to leave me, or if they don't respond, it means they don't love me. CBT helps you to challenge those thoughts. Is this true? What's the evidence? Or is this just my past trauma speaking? For a neurodivergent person who maybe has low self-esteem from years of not fitting in, CBT can address core beliefs like I'm not good enough for anyone, which fuels insecure attachment. By reframing those beliefs, I have a lot to offer, my partner chose me for a reason, the person can approach the relationship more securely. CBT can also help with concrete skills like organization and consistency, useful for ADHD. Fewer drop balls means less conflict. Perspective taking, maybe when she said I need space, it's not about me, maybe she's just tired. These cognitive shifts reduce triggers for attachment anxiety or avoidance. Dialectical behavioral therapy, or DBT, is a therapy that's fantastic for emotional regulation and interpersonal effectiveness. It was originally developed for people with borderline personality disorders who often have severe attachment trauma, but now it's widely used for anyone who has intense emotions, which includes a lot of neurodivergent folks. For example, those with ADHD mood swings or autistic meltdowns. DBT teaches specific skills in modules. Mindfulness, being present and aware of feelings. Distress tolerance, surviving crisis moments without making things worse. Emotional regulation, understanding and managing your emotions. And interpersonal effectiveness, communicating needs and setting boundaries in healthy ways. For a neurodiverse couple, one or both partners learning DBT skills can be a game changer. For example, if an argument starts to heat up, a partner practiced in DBT might use a distress tolerance skill, like taking a 50-minute timeout to splash cold water on their face or do some deep breathing, instead of yelling or using interpersonal skills, like I feel, insert emotion, when, insert situation, and I need to, insert request, to express themselves more calmly rather than blaming. One tip from DBT that couples use is the HALT rule. Don't have serious talks when you're hungry, angry, lonely, or tired. How many fights could be avoided by just postponing it to after dinner or a good night's sleep? Another DBT concept is validation. If you disagree, you try to first validate that the other's feelings are real and make sense of their perspective. And this is huge in any relationship, but particularly if, say, a neurotypical partner doesn't get why their autistic partner is upset over a noisy environment, they might be tempted to dismiss it. Why are you so upset? It's just a little noise. A DBT-informed approach would be, I understand loud noises can be really overwhelming for you. Let's step outside where it's quieter. This de-escalates situations effectively. In fact, one clinical recommendation specifically notes that people with very intense emotions, which could include some neurodivergent individuals, or those with disorganized or fearful attachments, often seen with borderline personality disorders, these people often benefit from DBT to handle those emotions in relationships, provided that they engage with the therapies. Social skills training and communication skills. Many neurodivergent adults pursue some form of coaching or skills training. For autism, this might involve learning to read facial expressions or practicing reciprocal conversation, perhaps with a therapist or in a support group. For ADHD, it might be learning time management or active listening techniques to not impulsively interrupt, for example. These skills directly feed into attachment. The better you can attune to your partner and meet obligations, the more secure the attachment becomes. There are also couple skills training programs. For example, some therapists use structured programs for neurodiverse couples where they practice specific scenarios, kind of like a playbook in football. When X happens, try Y instead of Z. So let's list a few practical strategies that neurodiverse couples can try right away. And these are gleaned from therapy practices and experienced couples. You can establish clear routines and expectations. As we've touched on, routines can become a lifesaver. Consistency equals security. Maybe you have set a time each week that's our time, like that Friday pizza night. So the neurodivergent partner isn't anxious about unpredictable social demands, and the other partner knows that they'll get their connection time. Or each morning you spend 5 minutes checking in with each other. Routines create a reassuring rhythm. Research with ASD kids shows predictability and routine foster secure attachment. And similarly, in adult life, having predictable patterns, like how you handle goodbyes or when you discuss issues, can soothe nerves on both sides. Use direct communication and translations. Don't rely on hints, sarcasm, or hoping your partner will just know what you need. Say it clearly. This might feel unnatural if you're not used to it, but it prevents so many misunderstandings. For example, instead of sulking and hoping your partner notices you're upset, you might say, "Hey, I'm feeling a bit ignored. Could we talk or cuddle for a few minutes?" On the flip side, the neurodivergent partner might need to express things explicitly too. "I'm not great with the flowery words, but I want you to know that I really appreciate you making dinner." Or even, "I love you. No, I don't say it often, but I do." Creating a shared vocabulary or signals can help. Some couples can even develop a color code or use emoji texts to signal feelings when verbal communication is hard. For example, sending a blue heart emoji might mean "I'm feeling down, need some comfort." It sounds silly, but for someone who struggles to articulate emotions in the moment, it's a vital tool. The key is tailoring communication to be clear and concrete, which might include writing. In fact, using visual or written communication can be great. One resource suggests things like notes, emails, or even a whiteboard at home can be easier for autistic individuals to process instead of spoken word. If a face-to-face confrontation is too intense, try writing a letter or email to each other about the issue. It gives the ND partner time to absorb and respond without pressure. One thing that I personally do is use the Notes app in my phone. I will pre-write my conversation and edit it over a few days to make sure that the point I'm trying to make is well made. The trick is to make sure you're sending it to someone that's receptive to reading it. Respect sensory and emotional needs. This is huge in neurodiverse relationships. Have open conversations about sensory preferences. Maybe one partner needs a low light, quiet space at the end of the day to decompress, so you agree that from 6 till 7 p.m. they take that time while the other one handles the kids or does their own thing. Or one partner might really find touch, like massages or hand-holding, soothing and connecting. So they ask the other, who might be touch sensitive, when and how can we incorporate touch in a way that you're comfortable with? Perhaps they discover they like firm pressure but not light touch, so a good compromise is a 10-second firm hug each morning,
being mindful of things like noise, lighting, crowds, etc., especially for the sensory sensitive partner, is a form of love and attachment support. It shows, I care about your inner experience and I will adjust to make you comfortable. Likewise, respecting emotional needs means if one partner needs more reassurance, you learn to give it. I love you, I'm not leaving, said in different ways, frequently. If that's what they need to hear, if the other needs more space, you don't take it personally and allow them that breather. It's a dance of meeting in the middle. Developing a repair process for conflicts. No matter how well you plan, conflicts will happen. What's critical is how you repair afterwards. We mentioned rupture and repair earlier. Couples should create a toolbox for repair. This might involve taking a time out if things get heated, but importantly, coming back to address the situation later. Avoidant folks, this means you. And then practicing making sincere apologies and forgiveness. Neurodiverse couples might need to explicitly learn how to apologize and forgive in each other's language. For example, an autistic person might prefer a very straightforward apology. I realize I hurt you by doing X. I'm sorry, it won't happen again. Without too much reading between the lines, their partner might need to hear an emotional component. I feel really bad that I hurt you. Coaching each other on what a good apology looks like for you can help. And when someone makes an effort to repair, try to acknowledge it and let it in. Over time, consistent repair builds greater trust. You both learn that even if we fight, we can find our way back, which calms the attachment alarms. Use external tools. Sometimes tools like reminder apps, calendars, or written agreements can minimize friction. If the ADHD partner forgets appointments or promises, set phone reminders for them or have a shared Google Calendar. If the autistic partner has trouble initiating conversations, maybe have a journal you can pass back and forth each week with notes to each other. It might seem mechanical, but it's scaffolding that holds up the relationship while you build those skills. For instance, a couple might have a whiteboard on the fridge that says, "This week, I felt loved when you blank," and they fill it in for each other. It encourages positive feedback, and it also clues the partner into what actions mattered. Educate yourselves. Learn about each other's neurotype. If you're an NT with an autistic partner, read books or blogs by autistic adults about relationships. If you're ND with an NT partner, maybe read about attachment styles or typical communication differences. Both of you learning about neurodiversity and attachment science can make it less personal. It's not that you're doing this to annoy me, it's that, oh, this is a known ADHD thing, or this is my anxious attachment acting up. It gives you a target, the pattern, instead of blaming the person. All of these strategies boil down to one core thing, creating a more secure attachment bond despite neurological differences. And it is possible. With patience and practice, an insecure pattern can gradually become more secure. Attachment research even shows that people's attachment styles can shift towards security over time when they are in a stable, understanding relationship or therapy. One blog encouragingly put it, "Your attachment styles can change and you can learn to attach more securely." Basically, we're not robots doomed by our past. The brain is plastic. New experiences can reshape how we connect. For a neurodiverse couple, each successful moment of understanding and empathy is a new positive experience that challenges the old insecurities. See, I can be myself and still be loved. Or I can trust that when they say they need a break and they'll come back, it isn't abandonment. Over time, these moments create a new narrative for the relationship, one of safety, acceptance, and teamwork. Remember, seeking professional help is also a valid and often important strategy. There are therapists who specialize in neurodiverse couples. They understand both attachment and neurodivergence, and they can coach you through these strategies in real time, which can help to accelerate the process. Group therapy or support groups can also be wonderful. Hearing from other couples with similar stories helps you feel less alone, and you can pick up tips from their experiences. So whether it's through therapy or DIY strategies, the goal is to foster secure attachment. And that means that both partners feeling they can rely on each other, feeling seen and accepted, and confident that they can work through issues together. It might not look like a neurotypical versions of secure attachment. It might be quieter or quirkier, but if you feel safe and loved, that's what counts. In this section, we're going to get a bit nerdy, but in the best way, and look at some of the latest research findings at the intersection of attachment and neurodiversity. For those who love the science, this is for you. But if you're not a research junkie, don't worry. I'm going to try and keep it understandable and highlight why it matters for real relationships. One key area of research is looking at how neurodivergent traits correlate with attachment security or insecurity. We mentioned some findings earlier. For example, a comprehensive review found that adults with ADHD have significantly higher rates of insecure attachment styles compared to the general population. The authors concluded there is a clear association between ADHD and attachment issues, likely rooted in a mix of the person's early environment and their ADHD-related challenges. This suggests that if someone has ADHD, it's worth being mindful of attachment patterns, and interventions might need to address both ADHD symptoms and attachment work hand in hand. On the autism side, research is a bit more complex and sometimes mixed. Early studies with children indicated a higher risk of insecure attachment in kids with ASD, but also showed that there are many autistic children that do form secure attachments, especially when their caregivers are attuned to them. A meta-analysis by Rutgers et al. In 2004 found roughly 50% of autistic children were securely attached. Lower than typical kids, but not drastically so. More recent studies have tried to understand what factors lead to security versus insecurity in ASD. One theme is that when parents, or later partners, can speak the autistic language, providing consistency, understanding sensory needs, using clear communication language, this person with ASD is more likely to develop secure bonds. When there's a mismatch or high stress, like a parent who doesn't know the child is autistic and inadvertently frightens or confuses them, insecure attachment is more likely. A fascinating study in 2010 looked at married couples where one partner had more autistic traits, not necessarily diagnosed ASD, but high on the autism quotient scale. They found that more autistic traits were associated with lower relationship satisfaction, but interestingly, this was significant for husbands with autistic traits and not for wives. It turned out that the link between a husband's autistic traits and his lower marriage satisfaction was mediated by things like reduced emotional responsiveness, lower trust, and less intimacy. In plain terms, men who had more autistic characteristics tended to struggle with the kind of emotional engagement that fosters a happy marriage, at least in that non-clinical sample. However, their wives didn't necessarily report being less satisfied. There was no partner effect, meaning the wife's satisfaction wasn't directly diminished by the husband's traits in a one-to-one correlation. And that's interesting because it suggests that sometimes the neurodivergent partner might themselves feel less fulfilled or connected, perhaps aware on some level of the emotional gap, even if the other partner is coping or not blaming them. It points to the importance of helping autistic individuals themselves with attachment-related skills, like emotional responsiveness, for their own relationship happiness, not just for their partners. Another research area is mentalization and attachment within autism. We touched on mentalizing deficits, difficulty reading minds essentially, in autism. One recent review in 2023
by Costa Cordella et al. Argued that to effectively help autistic children, and by extension, likely adults, with social relationships, therapies could integrate attachment issues and neuroscience, basically acknowledging that attachment, neurobiology, and mentalization are all tied together in autism, shaping social outcomes. This holistic approach has led to adaptations of mentalization-based therapy, or MBT, for autism. MBT is a therapy originally for borderline personality disorder that focuses on improving the ability to mentalize, understand one's own and others' mental states. Early trials groups, MBT for adults with ASD, show promise in helping them better interpret social cues and reflect on relationships. Now, why is this an attachment story? Because if an autistic individual can improve at mentalizing, they're likely to feel more secure in relationships, less confused by others' actions, and their partners will feel more seen by them. It's now bridging the empathy gap from the other side, training the muscle that reads emotions. Now, regarding ADHD relationships, beyond attachment styles, research has looked at things like divorce rates and satisfaction. Some older studies indicate that couples with one ADHD partner reported more distress and higher divorce rates than non-ADHD couples. But those outcomes were not set in stone, especially if ADHD is managed. A study in 2021 by Magilski et al. Found that ADHD symptoms, especially the inattention, in one partner were associated with the other partner feeling less satisfied, partly because the ADHD's partner's forgetfulness or disorganization led to more conflict and feeling unsupported. However, when couples actively work on strategies like using reminders, dividing tasks according to strengths, or going to couples' therapies, many can reach comparable satisfaction to non-ADHD couples. The key factors were impulsivity and emotional dysregulation. These, more than the other ADHD symptoms, tend to rock the relationship boat. Impulsivity might lead to rash decisions or hurtful words in the heat of an argument. Emotional dysregulation might lead to frequent arguments or roller coaster dynamics. Now, research suggests that teaching ADHD folks emotional regulation skills, sometimes borrowing from DBT, as we mentioned, can stabilize their relationships significantly. So essentially, ADHD's impact on attachment and stability is largely mediated by how well the person can regulate impulses and emotions, which is something that can be improved with treatment, medication, therapy, or coaching. Another interesting angle is the role of the neurotypical's partner's attachment style. It's not only the ND partner that brings an attachment style, the NT has theirs too, and that can either buffer or exacerbate issues. A study highlighted that if a neurotypical partner has a secure attachment, they might better weather some of the storms, providing steady reassurance to an anxious ADHD partner, or patiently giving space to an avoidant autistic partner. On the other hand, if you have, say, an anxious neurotypical and an avoidant autistic together without awareness, it can become a massive challenge. Recent couples research suggests matching interventions to these patterns. For example, if one is anxious and the other avoidant, therapy might focus on helping one to self-soothe so they're not constantly panicking, and the other to reach out more so they don't stonewall. In neurodiverse terms, if the anxious one is ADHD with RSD and the avoidant is autistic with shutdowns, the work is quite tailored. Maybe the ADHD gets therapy for the RSD triggers and the autistic learns scripted ways to understand stress. Lastly, I want to mention research on the positives outcomes side. We often focus on the problems, but what about the unique positives? There is emerging qualitative research where neurodiverse couples are interviewed about what makes their relationship work. Common themes that come up are deep appreciation of the other's differences, complementary skills, like one might be detail-oriented,
the other the big picture, which together makes them a great team. To use a personal anecdote, I recognize my own differences in social situations, and in a professional context, I love working with people whose extroverted, compassionate, and social side compensates for what I lack. I think it makes us a much more efficient team. Some neurotypical partners report that being with a neurodivergent mate taught them to communicate more clearly and be more accepting of differences in general, which improved not only that relationship, but also their other relationships. And neurodivergent partners often say they've grown in emotional awareness or social skills thanks to the patience and feedback of their partner. It's a two-way street of growth. So, academically, there's interest in studying these strengths more systematically. What conditions enable neurodiverse couples to thrive so that therapists can promote these conditions for others? To wrap up the research highlights, mentalization difficulties in ASD can impede attachment, but therapies are being developed to tackle it. Insecure attachments are common with ADHD, largely due to impulsivity and emotion issues, but addressing those can improve relationship stability. Many autistics do achieve secure attachments, especially with supportive understanding communication. Predictability and structure help. Autistic traits might lower relationship satisfaction, but it's for the autistic individual. If emotional intimacy is low, pointing to a need for interventions focusing on building intimacy and responsiveness on both sides. Early studies on therapy, specifically for neurodiverse couples, show improvements in communication and emotional awareness, validating that seeking therapy can yield measurable benefits. All of this research underscores a hopeful message. With better understanding by both science and society of neurodiverse attachment, we can develop better tools and supports. Couples don't have to figure it out alone in the dark. There's growing knowledge to light the way ahead. I appreciate we've covered quite a lot in today's episode, from the basics of attachment theory to the nuances of neurodivergent communication, from relationship challenges to therapy tips and research findings. So let's just summarize the key insights and end with some encouragement and resources. The key takeaways: attachment styles, secure, anxious, avoidant, disorganized. They are patterns of bonding that start in childhood and influence how we behave in adult relationships. They are not labels to put you in a box, but tools for understanding your fears and needs in love. Everyone can move towards security with the right support. Neurodiverse individuals, like those with ASD or ADHD, absolutely form attachments and desire love and connection. They may express their attachment in unique ways due to differences in social communication or sensory processing. Misinterpreting those differences can lead to unnecessary hurt. Autistic love might look different, but is no less real. For example, an autistic partner might show care through actions and honesty rather than flowery words. ADHD partners might be spontaneous and passionate, yet need help with consistency. Challenges in neurodiverse relationships often stem from communication gaps, sensory or emotional mismatches, and differing attachment needs. One partner might crave more reassurance while the other needs more space. One might speak bluntly and the other takes it personally. Emotional regulation issues like meltdowns, shutdowns, or rejection sensitivity can create conflict cycles. Recognizing these patterns as part of a neurodiverse dynamic, not as character flaws, is the first step to addressing them. Strengths in these relationships are powerful. Many neurodiverse couples share extraordinary loyalty, authenticity, and a deep appreciation for each other. They often connect over shared interests or values at a level that's very profound. By embracing neurodiversity, couples can create their own version of romance that might defy stereotypes, but is incredibly intimate and fulfilling. the directness and reliability of a neurodivergent partner, for instance, can make for a very secure feeling partnership. Therapy and strategies can greatly improve neurodiverse relationships. Emotionally focused therapy helps couples understand each other's attachment needs and fears, turning conflict into bonding moments by fostering empathy and vulnerability. CBT can reframe negative thoughts that fuel insecurity, and DBT teaches skills to handle emotional storms and communicate effectively. Practical tools like establishing routines, using clear and direct communication, accommodating sensory needs, and having a game plan for conflict can prevent many misunderstandings. It often comes down to being explicit and kind. Spell things out rather than assuming, and assume good intentions rather than ill will. Recent research gives hope and direction. It validates that neurodivergent individuals might have higher odds of insecure attachment, but also highlights that this is not a life sentence. It's something we can work on. Studies show that with understanding and support, many neurodiverse people form secure, loving relationships. The research is also leading to tailored therapies, like mentalization-based approaches for autism, that address specific needs. And importantly, it busts myths. Autistic people do want and can maintain relationships just as much as others, and ADHD folks aren't doomed to chaos. Awareness and coping strategies make a huge difference. If there is one overarching message, it's that attachment and neurodiversity don't have to clash. They can complement each other once we bridge the understanding gap. Neurodiverse relationship might need some extra care, education, and adaptability, but it can achieve the same secure, loving bond as any other. In fact, going through that process often creates an even stronger connection, because you've truly learned to see and accept each other on a deep level. To all the neurodiverse individuals and their partners out there, you're not alone. Your relationship isn't broken or doomed because of neurological differences. It may be different, yes, but different can be beautiful. With patience, empathy, and sometimes a bit of outside help, you can turn challenges into growth. Celebrate the small victories. The first time you resolved an argument calmly, or the day you realized you hadn't worried about a certain trigger in weeks. Those are signs of your attachments becoming more secure. Before I sign off, I do want to provide some resources for further learning. So there are a few books, a book entitled Attached by Amir Levine and Rachel Heller, a great intro into attachment styles in relationships, not neurodiverse specific, but a very useful foundation. The ADHD Effect on Marriage by Melissa Orlov, an excellent guide specifically for ADHD and neurotypical couples. It's full of practical advice and understanding. Or Loving Someone with Asperger's Syndrome by Cindy N. Ariel offers insight and strategies for couples where one partner is on the spectrum. Got therapy and support. If you think professional help would benefit you, look for therapists who mention terms like neurodiverse couples therapy or neurodivergent affirming therapy. There are also online communities and directories, for example, neurodiverse couples support groups on Facebook, and sites like the AANE, the Asperger's Autism Network, that offer support groups for couples. There are podcasts and blogs like ADHD Rewired or this podcast, where we regularly discuss relationship issues. Don't hesitate to reach out, because sometimes hearing others' similar experiences is incredibly validating. There are also online communities. Reddit has positive communities like r/autismpartners or r/ADHD_partners, where people share experience and tips. There's also the Neurodiverse Couples section on Wrong Planet, which is an autism forum, for general attachment work. You've got the Attachment Project website, which has got free quizzes and articles. And places like the Gottman Institute offer science-based relationship advice that can be adapted to your situation. As one final call to action, I invite you all to share your experiences
or questions with me. Did something in this episode resonate with you? Do you have a story overcoming an attachment challenge in a neurodiverse relationship? Or maybe still you're struggling with one? I'd love to hear it. You can email me or comment on any of the social medias. Your story might help someone else feel less alone. We may feature it in a future episode, with permission, and anonymously if preferred. Also, if there's a specific topic you'd like me to cover in the future, maybe parenting when you're neurodivergent, or friendship dynamics in neurodivergent, then let me know. The podcast is all about understanding and connection, and that works best when it's a two-way conversation with me and you. Thank you for spending this time with me. I hope that you're walking away with a deeper understanding of yourself or your loved ones. Remember that every brain is different, every attachment is unique, and there is no wrong way to love. It's about finding out what works for you and nurturing that. Be kind to yourself and to each other. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe, leave me a review. It really helps others to find the show. I will pin all the sources and resources mentioned in today's show in my notes. I'll put links and references out there for anyone who's research-minded and curious to learn more. See you next time. Thanks for listening to Navigating Life with Neurodiversity. If this episode resonated, follow on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts from. Share it with someone you care about or leave a review. It all helps more than you know. Until next time, be kind to yourselves.